Good morning, church. It's so good to see you. So good to be with you. It is. It's always a blessing to be gathered with God's people on a day of praise and thanksgiving. And it's always great to be with God's people, even on days that it's difficult. Maybe especially on the difficult days. It's good to know this morning that there are at least two people who get my jokes. And if your expectations are for humor up here, you're in the wrong congregation. You've got to be down here. You've got to be right down here. That's where my jokes generally go. Appreciated that word of comfort and encouragement there from Nick. And I'm also thankful this morning for Steve and Susie Lowry's 50 years of marriage. What's particularly encouraging about that for me is if Steve and Susie can do it, really? they're just a big encouragement to me for a variety of reasons. Appreciate them so much. I'm looking forward tonight to our gathering, Cedar Forest. We're going to try to make it. I know it's a crazy day. But if you can be there, I really think it would be a good and beneficial thing for us, for the people of Cedar Lane, for everybody to get together, and we'll spend some time together, eat some food together, play some games together. I think that would be a really, really good thing. Encourage you to come, even if you can't bring food. Just come. Just come and be there. On November 30th, 1954... a resident of Alabama, her name was Anne Hodges. You've probably never heard of her. But she became the first, and quite possibly the only person to ever be struck by a falling meteorite. It was an 8.5-pound rock, and it crashed through her roof, bounced off the radio, and struck her in the hip as she was taking a nap on the couch. According to an astronomer and meteorite expert, his name is Michael Reynolds. I'm assuming no relation, but his name is actually Michael Reynolds. He said the odds of a meteorite striking in a populated area, let alone an individual person, are staggeringly remote. He said you'd have a better chance of getting hit by a tornado, a bolt of lightning, and a hurricane all at the same time. But from there, from this point in her life, Mrs. Reynolds' life took this downward spiral. She only suffered a bruise. That was a nasty bruise on her hip from the incident, but it thrust she and her husband into the spotlight. I'm kind of hanging up here. She was overcome, but so the media all gathered around outside. She was overcome by the mob of people outside her house, so she was transferred to the hospital so she could recover. And then came this nasty court battle with her landlord, who claimed that this famous space rock actually belonged to her since it hit the house that she owned. Ms. Hodges eventually won the lawsuit, but she never even found a buyer for what she and her husband hoped would be a valuable object. Instead, she had a nervous breakdown, divorced her husband, died at the age of 52, alone in a nursing home. Sometimes it feels like our lives are spiraling and we have no control. It's like our lives are sort of just unraveling right before our eyes, and it's all we can do just to hang on. And when we're reading the book of Jonah, from Jonah's perspective, it has to feel that way, right? I mean, one day he's at home with family or friends, we don't know, but he was at least home and doing normal by his standards, whatever those standards were. And then, like a meteorite out of the sky, God calls Jonah to go to Nineveh, and from there, everything just goes haywire, right? Just everything falls apart. It sets his life on this trajectory that has brought him to the point we got to last week where he's being thrown overboard in a stormy sea by pagan sailors and swallowed by a giant fish. So what now? Now that he's gotten to this point, what now for Jonah? What's Jonah going to do? I mean, what effect can Jonah even have upon his own life? Because everything has been taken from him. What can Jonah even do? So beginning in chapter 2 of Jonah, we read from inside the fish. And by the way, don't get hung up on fish or whale. Somebody says Jonah and the whale, that's fine. The word Hebrew word for fish just means a giant creature from the sea. It could be a whale, could be a shark. We don't know. It was just something that lived out there. So don't get hung up on that. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, in my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From deep in the realm of the dead, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the depths, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me, and your waves and breakers swept over me. Breakers here just means like, I think, piles of water. Just everything mounding up on top of him, right? I said, I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth barred me in forever. Now I want you to think about Jonah's story, at least up to this point. Jonah's story is one of continual descent. And I don't think that the language that Jonah uses throughout his book is accidental or a happenstance. So Jonah, after God calls him in chapter 1, Jonah goes down to Joppa. And then when he gets to Joppa, he goes down to the ship. Then when he gets on the ship, he goes down into the hold. And then from there, the sailors throw him down into the sea, and he's swallowed by a big, big fish that takes him down to the very bottom of the sea. From our perspective, the way we might phrase this is that Jonah has now hit literal rock bottom. He says I'm to the roots of the mountains, right? I'm not just in the sea, which is a terrible place to be, storm or no storm. He's at the very bottom of the sea. And from his perspective, this is not a temporary predicament, right? This is the end. He's at the point that he says, I'm going to be barred in this land forever. You know, the land has barred me in. It's like being thrown in a cage, right? Barred. Held right there. Have you ever felt like that? Like it's not just something bad happens, but like it's so bad that your life has been shipwrecked in an unreachable place that nobody even knows you're there. Like the bottom has fallen out, or you're clinging to the end of your rope and just hanging on by a thread. All of those analogies work. If you've ever felt like you've gotten to that point, then you can identify with Jonah here. And from Jonah's perspective, again, what makes it all worse is that this is God's doing. This is not just an accident after an accident after an accident. This is, God is behind all of this. And, you know, we know that the sailors threw Jonah overboard, but you go back and you read this, and this is actually a psalm. It's a psalm of Jonah. It closely mirrors some of the psalms we have from the book of Psalms, like Psalm 30. It follows the same sort of pattern as many, many psalms. But Jonah, we know that the sailors threw him overboard, but that's not who he says threw him into the deep. He says, God, you were the one who threw me into the deep. Right? Everything that has happened to him has been God's doing. And worst of all, the worst of that is that Jonah says, I feel like I've been banished from your sight forever. Forever and ever. Banished from the sight of God. He says, I turned towards your temple. And temple here, it could mean a couple of things. One, it could be the temple in Jerusalem, but more likely in this context, he's speaking about God's heavenly temple. not heaven as the way you and I think of it, but God's eternal dwelling, whatever that might be in his Old Testament theology. But he believes, he's like, he turns towards that, but he's never going there. That's never going to be home. I'm just looking towards it because I am barred from you forever. And so instead of being in a heavenly home, I'm in a pitch black, watery grave at the bottom of the sea where I'm never going to see light, much less anyone again, and no one's going to ever see me again. I'm never going to be found, right? This is not one of those stories of rescue. Jonah's, it's as bad can be. He's so far from God, so far from the peace and security of a life with God, that he believes this is the end. And you know what? I think if it had been the end, it might still be in the Bible. I mean, it'd still make a pretty good story. I don't know if we'd tell it to our kids or not because it's a sad one. But you know, this could be the end of Jonah's story right here. Don't disobey God. Lesson learned. Right? When God calls, don't run away. Got it. That's the lesson of Jonah, kids, is that when God tells you to do something, you do it or else. That is the end of Jonah's story. And that was a good portion of my parental advice growing up. Right? When mom or dad or a teacher or a principal or a policeman or somebody in authority over you tells you to do it and you don't do it and bad things happen, that's the lesson, just like Jonah. But this is not the end. It's not the end for Jonah. And it's certainly not the end for God. So continuing on in verse 6, he says, "But you, Lord my God, brought me up from the pit. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them, but I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord." It wasn't until Jonah's life was at rock bottom that he says, "I remembered the Lord," right? He's so busy thinking about Jonah and woe is me and all the bad stuff that's happened to me, but it wasn't until he hit that rock bottom that he remembered the Lord and he sent up a prayer to God. His prayer rose to God, right? This upward trajectory, and it was then and only then that the trajectory of Jonah's life changed. From that point on, Jonah's life goes from a downward trajectory into an upward trajectory. Prayer literally changed Jonah's life. And from your and my perspective, again, if you've been at this point where everything's gone wrong, you've lost everything and everyone, and it all feels like life is upside down, you feel helpless, you feel hopeless, and there's nothing else to do, and you're just like, it's all I can do to pray, and it feels like such a feeble thing, like shouting into the wind, right? Just almost a throwaway, because I can't do anything. I can't go and fight my enemy and overcome this. I can't have the money to deal with all these bills. I can't win back this relationship that's been severed. I can't do anything to fix what has taken my life down to this point. All I can do is pray, and that feels so feeble. It feels so helpless. It feels so hopeless. It's just like, I don't know what else to do. All I can do is pray. And yet that's what changed Jonah's life. The feeble prayer from a helpless man in a hopeless position changed his life. And what's really surprising, at least for me, is that if I try to put myself in Jonah's shoes. And when I do that, Jonah's actual prayer is pretty shocking. Because I can think of a lot of things I might say if I were in Jonah's position. Again, I've never been inside a fish, but if I were at what felt like the end of my life, at the end of my rope, no hope, that sort of thing. I can think of a lot of ways I might pray. This would probably not be what I would say. Because Jonah's prayer exhibits a shocking amount of faith and confidence in God right here. Because he praises God for his deliverance while he's still in the belly of the fish. He is praising God for his deliverance while he's still at the bottom of the sea. He's praising God. His circumstances haven't changed at all. But his attitude has changed completely. And what he says, it's beautiful. It is at the heart. This is the turning point for the book of Jonah, by the way. Literally, he says, salvation comes from the Lord, which is a beautiful sentence in English. In Hebrew, it's just two words. And I don't normally try to go into the Hebrew or Greek or anything like that, but it's kind of important in this particular circumstance. The two Hebrew words are Yeshuata LeYahweh. Yeshuata LeYahweh. And if you say those, even though you may not be familiar, or probably not familiar with Hebrew, if it sounds vaguely familiar even to you, it's because of the words. Because the Hebrew word for deliverance or salvation is Yeshua. Yeshua. When the angel announced to Mary that she would have a son, he said to her, "You shall call his name Yeshua, for he will save his people from their sins." Yeshua. Yeshua Yate. Salvation is from the Lord. Over the last few weeks, I confess that I, and maybe you too, have felt a little like Jonah. Like everything's on this downward trajectory, spinning out of control, and I haven't had the answers. Like, I've had some conversations, and I think people want me to have more answers than I actually have. I don't have them. I still don't have them this morning. But I will say what we can do is that we can lift our praise. We can raise our hallelujah. Not from the mountaintops, but from the mountain bottoms. Not because we now have all the answers, but because we have the ear of the one who does. I don't know when or how or what God is going to do. No idea. But I believe with all my heart that he will. And I believe that our God is mighty to save. If he can save us from the depths of our sin, if he can save us from our own moral demise, our own downward trajectory into a life of debauchery, if God can save us from that, he can save us from anything. And this morning, if you are struggling, if you are worrying, if you are afraid and confused and lost and alone, you're not actually alone, because our God is still listening. Raise your prayer. Lift your voice. Praise him for his deliverance, though you don't know when or how it'll happen. Let's do that together now as we stand and as we speak.